Good afternoon, everyone. It's February 28th, 2012, and it is now 3:10 p.m., and welcome to Rules. We are going to open up a public hearing and a work session on Senate Bill 1508A.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 1508A allows two or more beverage distributors to establish a cooperative for the purpose of collecting refund value of beverage containers and refunding to dealers the amount paid for refund value of empty containers, paying refund value for containers sold in-state, and processing containers sold in-state. It stipulates that if a cooperative is established, dealers using the cooperative are not required to return containers to distributors or importers who do not participate in the cooperative if an accounting is provided to the distributor or importer by the dealer. Requires that upon receipt of an accounting, the dealer or importer must pay the refund value to the dealer or cooperative that provided the accounting. It also specifies what beverage container return data is and requires the provision of such data to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission by July 1 of each year. It also prohibits OLCC from disclosing return data. It also establishes a violation of reporting requirements as a Class A misdemeanor and authorizes OLCC or the Oregon Department of Agriculture to revoke or suspend licenses of persons who willfully violate reporting requirements. Requires first reports of data by July 1, 2013, declares an emergency is effective on passage.
Very good. We'll have up Joe Gilliam and Paul Romaine.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. If any of you want to know our marriage counselor's name, we'd be happy to provide that after the hearing.
Don't really want to know.
Too much information.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Gilliam. I represent the Northwest Grocery Association, representing over 300 retail outlets around the state. And my members take in about 75% of the capacity of the bottle bill through our stores. That's required under the bottle bill. We're here today in favor of Senate Bill 1508. You've seen this bill in other forms before, 3704. Passed the House twice, plus a veto override. Passage. It is now back to you, finally through the Senate, and a 1911 bipartisan vote. And it is now in your committee for once again coming back to the, hopefully, the House floor. The bill is incredibly important for the bottle bill. So if you have an interest in the Oregon's bottle bill and its longevity, this is an incredibly important bill. In 2007, we passed Senate Bill 707, which expanded the bottle bill into water bottles, a big step after no expansion over at the time, about 36 years without expansion. As part of 707, an incredibly important link that changed the bottle bill for everybody across the state. Doesn't matter where your location is, if you're a retailer, distributor, or manufacturer, there was a huge change in the bottle bill, and that was the idea that we would change from only returning the brands that you sell at retail. So if you came in with in a Fred Meyer store with an Albertsons can under the old bottle bill, you refused the Albertsons can, and I had to go back to an Albertsons store. The system was in silos, so you only dealt with returns with those you traded dollars with. 707 changed that, and it was a very dynamic change in the bottle bill. It said that if you sell a type of liquid or some type of beverage, if you sell soda, you take all brands of soda in. If you sell beer, you take all brands of beer in. Sell water, all brands of water. Well, that's great for the consumer, because they could take all their containers to one spot and drop them off. However, if you can imagine trying to sort out the bottles in the back room and where they go, Fred Meyer has to go to Albertsons to get their nickel back, but they're out. Albertsons has to go to Costco. Costco has to go to Fred Meyer, and on and on and on. It changed the bottle bill forever. Respond to that. Private industry stepped up and took five processing plants, five co-ops around the state, and made them one co-op called OBRC, Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op. They're the ones who run the bottle drops, the two redemption centers we have running, the experiments we have running around the state. They serve as the clearinghouse. So rather than the retailers having to sort through this and making sure the nickels go everywhere, the nickels go into that pot. It gets sorted back through. Everybody gets their refunds made, and it keeps the system whole, and it makes the bottle bill run. Because of their activity and what they've been able to do, we were able to support House Bill 3145, which came through the body last session, that sets up an 8-year plan to expand the bottle bill. It's a business plan to get there. As part of that, you have to build the capacity to add to the model bill. So in, by 2018, we will build a capacity that will then handle the teas, the sports drinks, the Gatorades. Those will all be added to the bottle bill. A key component of that is this bill you have right here. It's the finishing piece. We went through this process of having this clearinghouse made and going through this process. What's extremely important to make all this work for the retailer, the retailer gets no pay for doing this. All the money in the system is from salvage and from the unredeemed nickels. That money goes to run the redemption centers, it goes to run the pickup for the distributors, and all that whole system of recycling is paid for by those dollars. For the retailer, there is no, there's no payback, there's no license, there's no handling fees, there's nothing like that. So what we're asking for in this bill is that we don't have to do separate sorts. So what this bill does is really a bill of the future for the bottle bill. What it says is, if you're a distributor and you choose not to participate in the large co-op, which right now is OBRC, it could be something different in the future. It doesn't lock it into one co-op. And if you choose, say, I don't want to be part of that system, that's great. But what it says is the retailer doesn't have to do separate sorts for all those brands. And you can make that choice, not participate, but you can't put the extra cost on the retailer to sort out your brand and say, we'll come pick those up. And that's what's happening with a couple small distributors you'll hear from later, but it's really not about them particularly. It's about how do you build a system that is going to accommodate 2018. The capacity for redemption centers that are working very well, make it convenient for the consumer, and make the system work for everybody without extra cost. It's a huge mandate that the state has put on retailers and distributors. This is what makes it work so we can process all the, you know, we're looking at a billion units that will go to 1.7 billion units that have to be handled in this state, brought back into recycling. It's a lot of cans and bottles. This bill right here in section 2, subsections 1 through 4, deals with the fact that we don't have to do separate sorts if someone chooses not to belong. So what does the distributor get? Well, they give up the salvage. So we're not sorting that out and pulling that out. That becomes the retailer's property, and it goes on in the system and is recycled. What they do keep is the unredeemed nickels. So whether they're in the co-op or out, they keep their unredeemed nickels, and that's where the money is in terms of operating their systems. That's where the, that's the only money out there. The rest of it, Section 5A, down through sub D into Section 3, deals with a very important component for the 3145, and that is figuring what the redemption rate is. Now, if I can just take a minute to remind you, there's a trigger in House Bill 3145. If redemption rates fall below 80%, the redemption rate, or excuse me, the refund rate goes to a dime, from a nickel to a dime. You have to be able to figure that rate, and there has to be a process of reporting those numbers to make sure that whether you're in the co-op or out of the co-op, that you're giving the numbers to the OLCC so they can figure the rate and they can say, well, you either made it or you didn't make it. And so the 10 cents relies on the numbers that are in subsection 5. That was not a piece of 3145. It was in this legislation, and so we need that piece to complete the business plan into 2018. Those are the components of the bills. I can give you more history if you'd like, or more detail. This is backroom stuff. This is very boring to the consumer. They won't see the difference, but it is a huge cost-driving factor in making the new bottle bill work in the 21st century. So I thank you for your time and your patience to listen to this. I know we've been here before, and I've explained it before, but I just thank you for your time on this. Madam Chair, I'll take any questions, or Mr. Chair.
You already.
You want me to talk?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Ms. Chair, everybody else in the chair, I'm Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. Let me kind of give you a little background on the bottle bill, since I'm more ancient than most folks here. About the only one who knows it probably better than I do is Representative Berger, because her father was the one who crafted the original version. The original version of the bottle bill was based on the concept of exclusive territories. The reason that's important is because the only products that were in the bottle bill at that time were delivered in exclusive territories. That meant that it was very easy to, for the nickel in the bottle to get reunited again. That occurred in the natural process because the person who delivered to Costco, at that time it wasn't Costco, but whatever it was probably delivering to another store where somebody actually was returning the bottle, like a Fred Meyer or Safeway, in the same geographic area. When it became apparent, and believe me, we fought expansion of the bottle bill for many, many, many years. Some of you were around for that. When it became apparent in 2007 that the expansion fight was going to be lost, we sat down and said, how do you make this work? Because now you have products that come into the state that aren't in exclusive territories. So you had to devise a new system. Somehow you had to set up a central bank. You had a number of choices to set up that bank. The state could have been involved. And believe me, DEQ was there and wanted it. And all the nickels would be paid into one central location, and the cost of the system would be skyrocketing. The beauty of the bottle bill, frankly, is that it is probably the most efficient environmental program out there and doesn't involve one penny of government. So we sat down and tried to figure out a system, and what we did was the co-op system, where everything had to go back to all the different stores, but we had to have a way to pick up that stuff. And that's what the co-op is all about. The grocer's cost in this system is in sorting. There are other ways to handle the grocer's costs. In Maine, what the system does is say, if you commingle, you don't have to pay a handling fee, or not as large a handling fee, but if you don't commingle, you have to pay the grocer a higher handling fee. In other words, if you choose not to be part of a group that is out there trying to make the cost lower for the grocer, then you have to pay more into the system because you're causing the costs of the system. All this bill does really is set up a way of doing that that's a little more efficient. You're saying, if you are saying that we want, in effect, a separate sort, because there is a separate sort for this kind of product, even when there is a machine, there is at least a bookkeeping sort, but usually there's a physical sort, you are going to have to figure out a way to compensate. And the way to compensate is simply say, you keep the scrap. You can sell it to anybody you want to sell it to. Right now, there's an exchange phenomenon. In other words, you give the bottle back, you get the nickel. The distributors don't own the can. The distributor doesn't own anything. They've sold it. What happens is, for example, it could be that the price of aluminum goes up to 10 cents a container on the open market. Maybe there's an aluminum shortage. Cans become very valuable. The grocer has the choice. It's their can. They could basically say, I don't want the nickel back from you. I'm going to sell it. It's not yours. It's mine. So all we're saying in this situation is, in those instances where you're causing the grocer additional costs, you have to pay something, or at least be in a position to pay something, and that something is a salvage value. There's been a lot of rumblings about antitrust. We went through the same thing when we set up the CRINC, which was Container Recovery in the Portland area. There were threats that we were monopolizing the market and all the different stuff, and we're basically into a position where my antitrust attorney can beat up your antitrust attorney. It really has come down to that. We have an opinion from a very prestigious law firm in Portland that the system that we have set up is just fine. If there is going to be litigation, nothing you do here is going to stop that. Or start it, frankly. So what we'd ask you to do is put this bill into place. Let us get on with implementing your bottle bill in the way that we are very proud to implement. This is the most efficient environmental program in the country. We have people coming out from other states to look at our system, and we ask for your support on the bill.
Questions?
One quick question. Joe, you said $1.7 billion. Is that when in full implementation containers? But we're running about how many a year now? Or do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, running just about $1 billion now.
A year. Exchanges.
It's an annual that's being returned to through the system.
Thank you. That's
the question. $1.7 is what we estimate by 2018, which is so adding 700 million units to the system.
Thank you. Anybody else? Paul, I just want to kind of ask a couple questions, because I've done a tad bit of research on this bill this last few days. I guess my first question would be at the tail end on the penalty stage. Maybe you can just describe to me and explain to me the history behind why this is a Class A misdemeanor carried over, you know, versus that of maybe a civil penalty. And then especially the way it's described, I mean, that you could, well, essentially be charged each day for numerous charges, I mean, for that. So maybe you can explain that to me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is that provision of the law, which is ORS 459992, and it's section 3, or paragraph 3 or section 3, whatever we call it, of that, is an old section that was in the original bottle bill. And basically, for whatever reason, a Class A misdemeanor is applicable in three instances: 459705, which is, let's see, where's my bill? 705, which is the if you fail to put a refund value on a container. 710 are different practices. In other words, you have to accept containers, and you actually have a misdemeanor if you refuse to accept. And let's see, those two, and 720, which is also, again, indication of a refund value. Those are parts from the original bottle bill. And I believe that the reason they were put in there as misdemeanors is you had a handle always on beer distributors because you had the OLCC who had an iron grip on the beer distributors, but you didn't really on soft drink distributors. There's no real soft drink agency besides maybe the Department of Ag. So I think it was probably put in there as more of a hammer over soft drink. It's, in my opinion, since 1972 when the law went into effect, it's never been used.
Okay, I know you've seen the letter from Governor Kulongowski regarding this whole thing to Secretary of State Brown, dated 8th, 2010. There's two things there that one, again, if we could kind of go back around and revisit the issue, because one of the things that he mentioned was the antitrust issue, that he had some concern there. I know we'll have some testimony a little bit later on this, but I'd really like to have your spin on that a little bit more. And then the other one was, I thought was rather interesting. Just read from this, members. In this letter, he says, "My concern is that the practical impact of this bill may actually hinder consumer recycling."
Mr. Chair, that was an interesting letter. The reality behind that letter was we didn't give enough during the negotiations to get in the bottle bill. We wanted, in fact, the governor really wanted what occurred, which is a complete expansion of the bottle bill. And those things were sort of used to say, we want you to come back to the table and, in effect, negotiate 3145, which you passed last session. Or was it 2009?
It had been 2009.
In 2009. You passed in 2009. Everything's blurring. At my age, everything starts blurring. The antitrust concerns, again, really what the bill did, what the co-op did, is increase redemption tremendously. We have, and Joe can actually give you the actual figures, but the two redemption centers we have out there are incredible successes, to the point where the third redemption center, which is being built out in Salem, is going to be tremendously larger than the first two. It's a program where you don't have to sit there and put cans in a machine and have it counted out. You basically have a bag that you drop off and you get credit for it. It's a simple system and consumers are flocking to it right now. And the more we can get these redemption centers built out around the state, the better the redemption rate will be. We've bet the farm on redemption rate, frankly, because if the deposit goes up to 10 cents, the amount of cross-border traffic is going to be absolutely enormous. So we are betting the farm that basically these redemption centers are extremely consumer-friendly and will let us succeed beyond anybody's wildest imagination in getting bottles and cans back to a place where they can be recycled properly. As far as the antitrust issue, again, again, I get to the point of everybody has their antitrust expert. I was just involved in a case up in Washington State where Costco sued the state of Washington over a lot of their alcohol beverage laws, and we went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit. We lost the case. I was representing the Washington distributors on the side of the state of Washington. We lost at the U.S. District Court, and we won at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's, you know, anybody can allege antitrust violations. It's very difficult to prove any kind of antitrust violation. And all you're doing in this situation, frankly, and this is why I believe antitrust is ridiculous, you imposed a bottle bill system upon us. This is not something we went out and schemed to do. Believe me, we have not schemed to do this thing. We've spent most of our life scheming not to do it. You imposed it. We are now trying to implement the system and simply putting into place those programs that will help us implement the system and make it work is not an antitrust issue.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and then actually we'd like to have a panel come up. Tim Martinez, Ron Bruce, Ed Elms, and Eric Young, please.
Representative Vince wants to come in.
Oh, did you want to come up? Okay. All right. If you guys would just hold off for a second. For you, oh, okay, bring them on up then. You're in control. So you're kicking out Tim Martinez and Representative Bentz, is that what it is?
For the moment.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Cliff Bentz, District 60, which is Malheur County, Harney County, Grant County, part of Lake County and Baker County. Today, I'm not an expert in the bottle bill, so I'm just going to mention some very simple points. The first one is we need to change the name from the bottle bill to distant relative and barely can see the bottle bill from here, bill. It's now a recycling bill. And I think to take refuge in that phrase, bottle bill, is incorrect and misleading to the consumers. The gentlemen that join me today are Ron Bruce from LeGrand, Ed Elms from Baker City, and Eric Yunt from Ontario. And they are gentlemen who relied upon what this body created, the original bottle bill. And to suggest that somehow they have been incorrect and relying upon us seems disingenuous. And to me, today, as I explain to you what they've done in reliance upon the existing law, that is their investment in trucks and facilities and employees, to suggest that somehow they shouldn't have believed us when it comes to who was going to get the scrap and who was going to get this business seems wrong. And to me, particularly in hiding behind the so-called bottle bill, this is a recycling bill. This is a recycling device, the function and focus of which is going to be to make everybody in Oregon recycle. Let's not call it anything else. And this is one step along that road. What's happening is these gentlemen are being shoved out of that road, and at great cost to them. And they'll explain that to you in much more detail, much better than I can. But I have made a point of voting against the expansion of the bottle bill for many reasons, some of which are relevant today, some of which are not. But what I think is most important is that we understand the consequences of the vote today, and these gentlemen will explain it. I would hope that you listen carefully and say to yourselves, what really is gained by adding these folks to this structure? What is really gained? And is it worth the cost of these gentlemen? That's what I would ask. And I appreciate your time. I am the first to acknowledge the complexity of this device. I've spent two weekends trying to figure it out, and then since that time, I've spent more time studying it. And I still can honestly say I don't understand all of it, or even maybe half of it. But I do know these gentlemen are extremely sincere in what damage the adoption of this bill will do to their businesses, and I'm very happy you've asked them forward to be able to testify to that. And since I don't think I can answer any of your questions, given the complexity of the bill, I shall take my leave and leave it up to these gentlemen. That's peace with your approval.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, thanks for traveling.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ed Elms. I'm from Baker City, Oregon. I'm the principal owner of a small distributorship called P&E Distributing, located in Baker City. It's a family-owned business formed in 1968, so we've been there even through the implementation of the bottle bill originally, which was quite a challenge, to say the least, but we've survived this long. My sons and I run the business together. We have 12 full-time employees, 3 part-time employees, and pay a livable family wage and benefits in that market area. Being from a rural area like Eastern Oregon, with about 7 people per square mile versus some of the metro markets, I can understand why it's a little complex to understand why there's such a difference there versus our market areas in regards to this bottle bill. Well, it's strictly geographics is all I can say, and the number of people. The markets I serve are Baker, Union, and Wallowa counties, so it's a 3-county area. Approximately 48,000 people. Our longest run is 265 miles round trip. So you can see it's considerably different than living in a metro market where you may have trucks that only travel between 5 and 15 miles a day to conclude their routes versus some of the routes of my trucks. I feel this bill, you know, is kind of forcing private business against private business in some way. We have a co-op that we formed years ago. We recycle all the products together, collectively. And by that, I mean we have recycle facilities in both Ontario, LeGrand, and Pendleton. And myself, being located in Baker, I use the one that's in LeGrand. So what I do is I collect the cans, I take them over and have them processed. By processed, I mean we crush those cans and bale them for recycle. We do the same with the plastic bottles. Our glass is a little unique in our area. It's used in the landfill. Is what they do is we deliver the glass to them, they take it out, they crush it, have an EQ permit in order to utilize that in their roadbed because it's a lot of clay. So they crush it in a small, you can't hardly tell it from a pebble, and they inlay that into their roadbed to help stabilize their roads in the dump itself, in the sanitary landfill. So kind of unique. And also the glass from Ontario from some of the distributors comes to that market for that very same use. So we don't have a big transportation cost. We're not carrying it all over the state in order to get rid of it. We actually have a demand for that item right in our own market. That's kind of unique. You don't see that happen very often. And glass is a big recyclable item. I heard little comments about keeping the nickels. I'll address that right now. We're on glass. My glass return, because of being located on a border area with Idaho, runs about 107%. So I buy back 7% more glass product than I sell. And we've talked about reporting for the state. Most distributors are nowadays pretty up to date on their return rate. My return rate on glass is 107. My return rate on plastics is about 97%, and my overall can return rate is close to 94%. So I don't have a lot of fluff out there to make a lot of money on, as the comments were made. I might be better off to some degree with glass if it were to go to a dime, and the percentage of increase would probably about put me out of business. So in some ways, maybe I'd be better off the other way, but I'm not saying that I condone that. But like I say, we formed a co-op. We provide the same service in Eastern Oregon that I feel they provide in these markets, with the exception of non-distributor handled products. Now, probably 75 to 85% of those products are recycled through reverse bin machines. I presume everybody's aware of how that works. I heard comments in regards to sorting. Reverse bin, there is no sorting. We don't have anybody out there manning those machines. The grocers don't have anybody manning the machines. The sorting is done by UPC number. It's collectively combined into either a bag or a bin. So, like I say, there's not a sorting charge at all that's involved with labor. No matter whether it's a co-op or an individual doing it, this cost is the same on a reverse bin. It's just it prints out a ticket by distributor, by OBRC, by whoever's identified as a manufacturer or a distributor for that product, and that's how the credit is issued to the store based on that reverse bin return slip. In our particular area, which is classified as Zone 5, there are 17 accounts with reverse vendors. They comprise of about 90% of the total returns in those market areas. So you can see people do like to use those reverse bins, and they're located at the major markets. Rural areas predominantly do not have more than one. In a lot of cases, they don't have any. So most of the exchange in those areas is done through the grocery store front door, so to speak, and that's just been a matter of fact for years, and I don't think you'll see that change in a lot of these areas. The problem we see a little bit also is credibility with this bill, where we only have 17 accounts that have the reverse bins. That means all the rest of the accounts do not have a reverse bin. So, you know, how are they going to determine what return level that we have in those accounts and what our redemption should be if we're not the ones doing the redemption? We all know that you can always write it down on a piece of paper, a sticky note or whatever, but how credible is that? And who's going to monitor the correct type of can, the correct type of bottle, whether it's our bottle, our competitor's bottle, our can, the competitor's can, or even items that are not even a redemption item that are in those bags that we would be redeeming. So there is a credibility issue there, I feel, in regards to our redemption on those items. We service all of our accounts on a regular basis. By regular, the major accounts and all the markets are serviced twice a week, outlying areas approximately once a week. Some remote outlying areas during the winter months are only once every 3 weeks. So, but those outlying areas, OBRC doesn't go to. We go to the distributors themselves, even those that are members of OBRC, go to those on an individual basis. OBRC would only service the off-premise accounts. All on-premise accounts, which would be bars, taverns, restaurants, would still be handled by ourselves. We would still do the exchange there. We would pick up the empties and bring them back to our facility just as we currently do. So you're not eliminating the whole segment of this recycling process, because we would still be involved even though we're not a member of their co-op. We're a member of our co-op. Our efficiencies would be depleted because of the fact we're already there. When we go to an outlying area, if we're 100 miles away, we service that account, we pick up their empties, give them the exchange at that time as far as a credit off the invoice, bring those empties back, and process them at that time on a regular basis. If we were not to pick the empties up, not to give the credit at that time, there's a lag time for that retailer to receive the credit, plus there's an inefficiency. We're going to send another truck, or someone else is going to go out to pick those. When I say we, I'm talking collectively, not we as myself. But like I say, there's such an inefficiency, and I think the mileage is a limitation there in Eastern Oregon. We're so much different than the metro markets because of that mileage and because of that population-based difference in those outlying areas. The plan we have put together over the last few years, approximately 40, has worked very successfully in Zone 5. We have strong grocer support. We have strong support from all the retailers, both on and off premise, that are not serviced by OBRC also. And we would like to continue to do that model. We don't want to be a problem. We want to be a part of any type of solution for recycling. But we feel as a co-op, we should have the right to provide our own destiny in that direction with the aid of the legislature in that direction. Years ago, when OBRC was formed, it was a collection of co-ops throughout the state that serviced the markets that had a population base. There was never a co-op that serviced Eastern Oregon market. They were not part of that collection that came together and formed OBRC. We were the first co-op to be formed in that market area for strictly for the recycling reason. In the event a redemption center was opened in our markets, we would be more than willing to participate. We're not sure how well they would be received because of the geographics and the smaller population base in those market areas, but we would still be more than willing to participate in those recycling centers and to help aid those and to help benefit the startup and everything else that's involved with that. We feel there can be a compromise between OBRC and the independent recyclers of Eastern Oregon. We are called Oregon Association of Independent Beverage Recyclers. We have approximately 17 member distributors in our market. that belong to that. And like I say, we feel that we would like to be part of the solution, and we are hoping that we could come to an understanding with OBRC. We have tried in the past, and, you know, that's always an ongoing challenge. I do not feel that legislatively we should be legislated into being a part of OBRC, as we are different in that degree, and I say just our location. That's about all I have. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Independent Bottlers and Recyclers. You have, as you've been told by Representative Bentz, several members who have come a long way today. I want to thank both of the co-chairs for having a hearing on this bill to give them a chance to testify. I would probably guess, at least in this short session, you're not going to have any Oregonians come a farther distance to speak to you. And hopefully you've already heard Ed and his passion towards this legislation, and you'll hear it from others. You want to hear them speak, not me, so I'll be very, very brief. Again, as Ed said, this bill, if passed because of the way it's written, would force them to disband a cooperative that's working very, very well. Hopefully you're receiving a handout. One of the members of the cooperative, Russ Strandholm, just coincidentally on January 31st, was named the Recycler of the Year in Pendleton, Oregon. And these folks are doing exactly what you want to have done as a result of the bottle bill. But they should, if they're going to be part of OBRC, they should be a business-to-business decision. There was some discussion about how others around the state have slowly come and have joined. And that's certainly an opportunity for these folks to do. And as Ed just mentioned, they have had discussions and are willing to continue to have discussions. But this bill kind of cuts off the discussion and says, you know, you're going to join or you're going to be punished revenue-wise. And again, nothing in the bottle bill that you passed in 2009 requires that private cooperative that's been set up. It's certainly a good model, and we're not here to say, you know, it's a bad model or saying we're trying to make that go away. It is a good model, and it's working for the majority of the state. It just so happens these folks over in Eastern Oregon already had an established cooperative that, as you heard, is redeeming some recyclables at over 100%. The last thing I'll say before I turn it over to the next presenter is that, you know, one of the things we've offered to do is let or ask you to ask your Judiciary Committee to look at this in the interim. Unfortunately, this bill, you know, the bill that was vetoed in 2010 and now this bill in the House has been heard both times by the Rules Committee. And as we all know, the Rules Committee has its own special dynamic. And we're strongly committed to working with Judiciary Committee to go over these antitrust issues and see if they are real. I mean, I heard what the first panel said. Your next panel, make sure you get some coffee, quit your yawning. It's going to be a couple of lawyers. So hopefully you'll pay close attention, because I think you'll what they have to say is very important. And with that, I'd turn it over to Eric.
Well, Tim, if it will make you feel a little bit better, you do have two members from Judiciary in here.
So. I'd say we do.
Yes, kind of warm your heart. Okay.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and members of the committee, first I want to thank you for letting us take time to speak with you today. I'm Eric Yunt, Pepsi-Cola of Eastern Oregon, La Grande, Oregon, and Ontario, Oregon. I'm the General Manager, Vice President of Sales. Been with the company 23-plus years, and obviously been dealing with the bottle bill and the redemption of deposit containers for several years, obviously. I'll be brief and short. Forgive me if I'm a little nervous. I've never testified before any committees in the state level. But our association has made several attempts over 3-plus years to meet with OBRC in regards of the collection of deposit containers in Eastern Oregon. We feel we can provide a very valuable service to OBRC. Why we feel that way is, in our locations, as Ed mentioned a minute ago, we travel large distances every day. We hit several locations 6 to 7 times a week. OBRC uses a third-party person to pick up empties in our market. And there's several locations. They're there once a week, once every 2 weeks. Again, we are there two, three, four times a week, some locations 7 days a week. If our accounts want recycle picked up, we do it on a daily basis. That's the service we provide. On September 9th, 2011, we provided another document to OBRC regarding a meeting with them to discuss the collection of deposit containers. And I won't read our proposal, but I'll put it in a nutshell. Our offer to OBRC is to say to them, let us collect the containers in Eastern Oregon. We will store those containers for you. We will not charge you any fees. The only fee we would charge you would be a fee we come up with between us and OBRC, our association, on what they feel and we feel is a fair rate to crush and store those containers. We feel that's a very fair proposition. They would not have to employ anybody to travel to Eastern Oregon, travel to locations to pick up containers that we're already there to pick up. There'd be less vehicles on the road. We have to go to these locations every day, almost every day, some locations. I know the Walmart in Ontario, we deliver every day to deliver product. So when we're there picking up our empties, it's a natural fit. We are attempting to come to conclusion with OBRC for the benefit of all parties involved. We're not trying to be a sore thumb or thorn in their side. And members of the committee, in no way, shape, or form are we on a free ride. With that, I'll give it to Mr. Bruce.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Ronald Bruce. I'm a third-generation bottler, owner of Pepsi-Cola Bottle in Eastern Oregon. And really quickly, thank you for hearing us. That's number one. Two, we didn't realize that we were going to have a hearing today. So some of the other members that are not here, I wanted to name real quick, was Wynn Distributing, Achanis Distributing, Gardner Distributing out of John Day, Hodgins out of Pendleton, and Nola Corporation out of Dallas. They could not be here today. First, this bill is very complicated. To me, the bill reads that there is only one co-op can exist in the state of Oregon for the bottle bill. Whether we join or not join, it still kind of shows us that we're going to have to in order to be part of this bottle bill. The second, this law is if this bill is made law, it stops us from continuing business the way we've been doing it for 40 years. Our efficiencies will be depleted if this bill is made law. The plan we have in place to satisfy Oregon's bottle bill in Zone 5, that's where we're all from, is working. We've been servicing our customers' goals and exceeding the goals of the Oregon's bottle bill since its inception, and at our cost, not the state's or the customer's cost. Very important for everybody here to realize this. This bill, if it's made law, in fact, increases our liabilities costs of doing business in our area, Zone 5, forcing us to pass on the cost to our valued customers and grocers. Our grocers are why we're in business. Our customers and their customers are why we're in business. I'm not going to digress from that. They're very important to us. As you heard from Eric, you know, we're in these stores 7 days a week taking care of them. We do not want them to have a handling fee. In fact, it's just the opposite. This bill, 1508, if made law, will directly take monies from one private business and give it to another private business. By law, making theft legal according to this bill. The state of Oregon has made deposit containers a means of exchange therefore causing us to implement certain business practices to incorporate deposit containers. With the addition of the bottle bill in 07, we made very little changes to the process to accommodate the state's additional requests. In spite of all these facts, OBRC is telling us we have to change the way we do business through legislation. The OBRC wants the pooled nickels that are not theirs and the aluminum scrap. This law is not necessary to further recycling in Oregon. We would welcome redemption centers. And as Ed said, to make this very clear, we would welcome being part of redemption center in Eastern Oregon, but not at the expense of joining OBRC. In our area, I think you heard Ed testify that we have about 7 people per square mile. I think Multnomah is 1,300 per square mile. I understand why a redemption center works in Multnomah County. I'm not supposed to digress, and I won't do that too much. I bought my first can crusher when I was 12 years old, and then sold it back to my parents at 6%, and then they paid me $2.50 to crush the cans that went through it. These processes, to expand on that a little bit, is the fact that now we have a can crusher that produces a 650-pound bale, a plastic bale that weighs 750 pounds, and we also have a cardboard compactor that also does the, you know, that compacts all of our cardboard. We do an extremely good job keeping our environment clean in our rural Eastern Oregon as far as redemption containers are concerned. And, you know, I hope you have this. If not, I would love to make copies and give this to you. Do some brochures that like what we're doing. A lot of them, including some big grocers. They understand what we're doing. They like our service. We love doing business with them, and we're going to continue to take care of our grocers. If you like this, I'd be more than happy to. There's phone numbers, contact information from grocers. Again, thank you for your time. We appreciate it. We wouldn't have drove all the way down here if we didn't think it was important.
Questions?
Comments?
You do?
Comment?
Go ahead. Representative Berger.
Gentlemen, thank you for coming. And thank you all also for the service that you have done and continue to do in your areas. We may disagree on the policy in here, but every time this comes up, and it's come up frequently in my life, I am struck by how familial and solid your businesses are. Every one of you said, well, my father or my grandfather or somebody else. One of the geniuses of Oregon's bottle bill is that it doesn't have the state, and I've tried to keep the state out of the bottle bill, DEQ. I've worked hard on that. But what ends up is exactly as you describe, a sort of inside industry, and those can get equally intense and difficult. I just want you to know that I appreciate the work that you do and the service you do to the folks that you care deeply about. And while some of the policy pieces in this bill affect you uniquely, and I probably will be on the other side of this, I do appreciate you. And I do hope that you and OBRC, I mean, you are in a way your own cooperative. And I hope that it can be worked out, that things can work for all of you, because I want you to know that we appreciate what you do. Thank you.
Gentlemen, yeah, thank you very much for traveling.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, next we have Jim Gardner, Andy Aubertine.
Good
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for Walmart. Walmart is the largest private sector employer in the United States. Walmart is the largest retailer in the world. We account for approximately 10% of all non-automotive sales in the United States. And Walmart is also a corporate citizen committed to the state of Oregon. We are in expansion mode, unlike some of our competitors. We are looking forward to the opportunity over the next several years of bringing the benefits of our uniquely low prices, and with it, increased employment to the tune of hundreds of jobs to every area of the state. Walmart is also a passionate supporter of the Oregon Bottle Bill, and we are an active member of OBRC and have recently signed on to the Salem Redemption Center. We look forward to continuing participation with OBRC and with the Redemption Center system. Because of our unique position in the retail market in the United States, we have, I would say, unparalleled experience with dealing with all sorts of redemption systems, recycling systems, and the like. And the company feels the passage of this legislation at this time is not necessary to ensure the success, the continuing success, of the Oregon Bottle Bill system or the build-out of the redemption system. If you reflect on what has happened since that first veto occurred, we have had a build-out of the redemption center, the Salem Redemption Center in particular. So something is happening right without this bill being in effect. The other thing that has happened, which I think is very notable, is that some of the prior recalcitrant distributors, Salem area, Astoria area, have actually, through private sector negotiations, not through government fiat or government inducement, they've come on board. They have negotiated deals with OBRC and are now participants. That should tell you a lot about the benefit of allowing the private marketplace forces to work here. Because I think you heard from the prior panel, there are discussions going on. And if you defer action on this bill, I think it's extremely probable you'll have some movement along the lines of what we saw previously with Astoria, with Salem area, et cetera. The other reason that we would urge you to defer action on this bill and as Mr. Martinez suggested, put this in the lap of the Interim Judiciary Committee to take a look at the very serious antitrust issues that have been raised, is because the last thing you want to do is to create a situation that might lead to an unintended impediment to the operation, the future operation of OBRC. When I think it was Paul Romaine indicated, there's sort of dueling lawyers on both sides of this issue, and you're going to hear from the best of them, Andy Arbertine, in just a minute. Andy, if I can take a moment to brag on him, was a prior head of the antitrust division in the Department of Justice and is uniquely qualified to talk to you about these issues. But the more important takeaway, I think, is that the antitrust concerns were sufficiently serious to lead the governor, the prior governor, who previously served as attorney general and as a justice on the Oregon Supreme Court, to base his veto in large part on those antitrust concerns. So that's not just some random lawyer giving you an opinion. That's the governor with prior experience as a Supreme Court justice and attorney general basing it on that ground. I think at the very least, you owe it to yourselves as legislative leaders to ask your expert committee, the Interim Judiciary Committee, no judiciary committee has ever reviewed these issues, to take a very careful look at this before you proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Andy?
Thank you. Chair Olson, Chair Kotek, members of the committee, my name is Andy Aubertine. I am an attorney in private practice with the firm of Aubertine Draper Rose, one of the founding partners
Before I worked at Albertine Draper Rose, I had another life as an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, where I did lead the antitrust enforcement action policies in the department, and worked with a number of attorneys general, including Hardy Myers, Governor Kulongoski, and others in creating and enforcing antitrust policy for the state of Oregon on behalf of consumers, on behalf of state agencies, and certainly to try to facilitate competition. And that's really what the antitrust laws are about. My firm was hired in 2010 to analyze House Bill 3704, which, for all intents and purposes, is the identical bill for this analysis as is Senate Bill 1508. I'm glad that I'm going last because much of what I intended to say has already been said, so I won't repeat that. I have already provided some written testimony, and I do not intend to go over that in detail. What I do intend to do is answer, respond to a couple of points by Mr. Romaine, and frankly answer directly Representative Olson's question about the antitrust implications of this bill. I think Mr. Romaine was a bit dismissive in claiming that the antitrust concerns here are ridiculous. It is true that antitrust cases are very complex, and it is true that they can be there's a lot of information, there are a lot of facts, and there's a lot of analysis that goes on. And for that very reason, we don't make allegations lightly in the field of antitrust. It doesn't help anyone. What we have here in this bill is anti-competitive in purpose and effect. And that cannot be denied. Because the first practical effect of this bill will be to not create a monopoly cooperative, but entrench the monopoly cooperative that already exists to the exclusion of competition from any other association that wishes to compete with it for recycling and for all that goes with the recycle of the beverage containers. Because if you look at the bill and the language very carefully, only one can exist by having more than 50% of grocers. Now, the response to that is, that isn't true. Grocers can be members of two cooperatives, thus giving that second cooperative the opportunity to compete with OBRC. The reality is, the members of OBRC, which purport to take the vast majority of the bottles and cans, and have the vast majority of the grocers, have absolutely no incentive to be a member of a second cooperative. What this bill will do is it will say, in no uncertain terms, there will be one cooperative. And that's it. Now, I heard Mr. Romaine say that the justification for this is because the Oregon Bottle Bill has imposed this on us. It is necessary. This is a mandate. I have studied the law very carefully. The law does not mandate a single cooperative to the exclusion of others. It doesn't. And there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that as much as there is an attempt by the bill's proponents to blur the line between actions of the state and actions of the private entities, this is going to be carried out by a private entity. Indeed, we heard in the context of questions from members of the committee that they're trying to keep the state out of that. And if that is the case, then it means this is allowing a private participant coverage of a single cooperative without any threat of competition, with a better plan, with a better idea, better costs, perhaps more efficiencies, to compete with that cooperative. They're insulated from that. And what's going to happen here is that despite the fact that this bill passes, it takes all of those other associations or would-be associations out of the equation. It's the OBRC plan or no plan at all. Now, it's not, that's not, if that isn't enough to demonstrate anti-competitive purpose and effect, let me share one more point with you. If you look closely at the bill, there is no doubt that distributors who do not join OBRC, their cost will increase. Distributors who compete with the distributors in OBRC, their cost will increase. Their revenue stream will go down, and their efficiencies will be lost. And in a market where a competitor or competitors engage in that type of action without justification, that can be deemed anti-competitive and exclusionary. And if it's used in any way, shape, or form to entrench, maintain, or further entrench a monopoly, that's where you get into antitrust trouble. It is as simple as that.
Now,
when antitrust attorneys get to that point and say, we've got a problem here. We've got a problem of what could happen based in the industry as it exists today with a single monopolist with over 90% of the market. You look then to see whether there's a defense. Is there some type of immunity that exists in the antitrust law or in the law, the bill itself, that provides immunity from unlawful conduct? My answer in 2010 was no, there is no defense. My answer in 2012 is the same. I do think it's important to note that legislative counsel in 2010 agreed with me on the point of there being no state action immunity defense. And I would like to read from a section of a letter that was generated back in 2010 where it says, there is a body of antitrust law governing the OBRC's conduct. Nothing in House Bill 3704 gives OBRC immunity from these laws. If the OBRC gains monopoly power and commits exclusionary conduct, it would be subject to private or public suit, just as any other firm in any industry. Members of the committee, that's not my letter. That's the letter from counsel for OBRC. That's a statement from its letter, the letter that Mr. Romain was referring to earlier. In fact, in 2010, the OBRC position was initially this. Yes, 3704, which now you see as 1508, did contain restraints. But it didn't matter because there was a Ninth Circuit case, the case that Mr. Romain alluded to, the Costco case, that provided immunity, that provided a defense, so that the conduct at issue would not create federal antitrust risk. Restraints contained in the bill, not a problem because of the Costco defense. I heard that. I read that in the transcript. I wrote a response. It was that response that went to Governor Kulongoski. Shortly after that, OBRC, or the Northwest Grocer Association's counsel, then responded. And I'll speak to that analysis briefly in a moment. But the position changed. The position was no longer, yes, the bill contains a restraint, but there is a defense under Costco. The response was now, there is no restraint, defenses aren't necessary. Now, it can't be both. So, if we take the position that I believe is the position, the final word, in 2010, which is there is no risk because there's no antitrust problem with the conduct, so there isn't a need for a defense, then there's absolutely no reason for Mr. Romain to invoke Costco today as he did. Now, to be fair, the reason he mentioned Costco, at least in this hearing, was because he was saying allegations are easy to make and tough to prove. Nobody's denying that. Nobody's saying that this case would be a slam dunk if it went to court. My position is simply this, that there is sufficient antitrust risk. It is undeniable. It is substantial. And this bill creates such a complexity, given the sector, the private sector of the market and the way it exists today, that you cannot simply say that antitrust problems are ridiculous. You can't say that. Now, let me make one more point, and then I will certainly answer any questions that you may have. We heard from the prior panel about what the independent distributors are willing to do, what they have done, what they're willing to do, whether it's a joint venture, whether it's sharing in some way in the cost of building a redemption center, whether a redemption center is actually going to work as well in Eastern Oregon as other places. They don't care. They're willing to build out in that area. And what they're saying in antitrust vernacular is we are offering less restrictive alternatives to what this bill would do. And that is something that in the antitrust law we look at. We look to see first if there are justifications, if there are defenses, and if there are less restrictive alternatives. And here, the defenses do not, frankly, they don't exist. The justifications are skinny, and there are less restrictive alternatives. And so when you combine that with the risk factors that I've laid out in my written testimony and in my letter to Governor Kulongoski, it seems clear that the right solution is to put this into an interim committee to study it carefully and to work it out and ultimately to let market forces work it out rather than to impose the legislature's will that favors one competitor over everyone else. So I thank you for your time and your attention, and I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Wingert.
Well, this is a mistake because I'm not an attorney and you are, but I'm going to ask this question anyway. I'm trying to figure out if your line of argument about the potential antitrust element of this is really an argument against the bill or against the idea that everybody in the state would be involved in one cooperative. Because it seems to me that if you're correct that there's an antitrust issue, it's the same whether they're forced by a bill to come together or whether the gentlemen at the back of the room work out and they become the last ones into this cooperative and everybody in the state willingly joins the cooperative. Aren't your issues basically the same no matter what?
Well, Chair Olson, Chair Kotek, members of the committee, Representative Wingert, there's a big difference. And the first difference is the bill, if passed into law, forces that upon the independent distributors and puts the authority in the hands of the monopolist cooperative to engage in conduct that will undeniably restrain income streams from the independent distributors, will undeniably raise their cost, and will undeniably not allow them to choose what business plan or what efficiencies they want. Now, if they choose on their own volition to negotiate some resolution, not necessarily membership into OBRC, but perhaps as a joint venture with OBRC, the way one of the members from the prior panel described it. Now you're letting these businessmen get together, hopefully maintain the efficiencies, and work out a resolution that doesn't stifle the competition. So I disagree respectfully with the proposition that it is inevitable that each one of these members in the back will become OBRC members. I believe there's an excellent chance, based on what I've heard, that there can be a compromise in the private sector that doesn't force choice out of their hands.
Well, that wasn't exactly my question, but I'm done.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Okay, that completes the testimony then. Thank you very much. Okay, we're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1508 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 1508 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Garrett.
Mr. Chair, I just need to put on the record, although I don't believe it's a conflict of interest, that my law firm was retained by some of the interest groups involved in this discussion, provided some of the legal analysis that's been referred to today. I was not personally involved with that, but I wanted it known for the record that my firm was engaged and has provided advice here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I move for recess briefly?
yeah, let's take a recess then for just a couple minutes.
Did you see it?
Yes, I saw it.
Okay, committee, we're back in order, and we're in the middle of work session. A motion has been made to move Senate Bill 1508 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation, and we are in discussion. Any further discussion? Yes, Representative Vire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one has been a little difficult sitting here trying to figure it out, but I think ultimately I go back to the fact that this bill has been before me and I voted on it in the past and I've supported it in the past, and I'm not really sure that I heard anything today that would make me change that. So I will be supporting it.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay, Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Wiener.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Holby.
Aye.
Co-Chair Kotek.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
No. Senate Bill 1508 passes and a carry. Representative Berger. Okay. I'm going to close the work session on
speech.
Yes. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1508. And members, we have in front of us
a draft LC.
An LC draft 325. It's
the signee die resolution.
Yes, go ahead, Chair.
Chairs and members of the committee, it's the signee die resolution, which alternates between chambers.
Is it our turn?
I believe so. Mm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move LC 325 be accepted as a committee bill. Is that the right term?
Introduced
as a committee bill for the Committee on Rules.
Okay. Representative Berger moves that LC 325, dated 2/28/12, be adopted as a committee bill. Is there any objection? Yes, Representative.
Simply a matter of discussion. I don't think we should be precipitous on this kind of bill, Mr. Chair. But I am ready to support it.
Happy for you. Okay, any objections?
You can tell you're getting the look.
So, members, we are adjourned. Thank you.
You could wait for